This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear how local environmental community groups are banding together to fight against Halliburton gas drilling.
Supposedly, the way out of our energy crisis, this will put us into a huge water crisis, polluting aquifers, polluting farms, ending the idea that we ever had a clean countryside.
We'll hear from a panel at the Left Forum titled How to Make a Revolution in the U.S., hosted by our own Michael Smith.
If you've listened to Law and Disorder, you'll know it's not by voting Democratic. So hear how to do it.
Stay with us.
Michael, Heidi, in May we have an interesting date coming up in Israel.
Yes, May 14th, which is, Heidi?
A Remembrance Day?
It's Israel Independence Day, the date of the Israeli Declaration of Independence in 1948.
But, you know, the Palestinians have a related day. They call it the Nakba, which is catastrophe in Arabic. And you know what's happened?
And that's due to the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes, displacement, pushing out, forcing out, during and after the 1948 war. And now what's happened, Michael?
Well, the Israeli parliament has passed a law forbidding Palestinians from taking notice of the Nakba on that day. And the person that put forward the legislation said that if people can't remember their past, they won't rebel.
As the news article said, on the 16th of March, the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, voted in favor of a law to forbid public mourning activities in Israel on the anniversary of the establishment of the State of Israel. So it's, Michael, it's your point that you just made about the legislator who said if they can't remember their past, they won't rebel. And, of course, I know you and I, Michael, have been working on a case that's similar to that, the attempt to obliterate the Muslim cemetery Mamilla in Jerusalem, again, an attempt to erase historical memory.
Well, we're part of a team of six lawyers that brought a petition to the United Nations asking the United Nations to investigate and try to get the Simon Wiesenthal Museum, which is in L.A. but wants to build a branch in Israel. And it's working with the Israeli government. The government gave them a 33-acre plot, which prior to the Israelis seizing West Jerusalem in 1948, when they set up their state, had been the most sacred and largest Arab-Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem. And now, you can't make this up, Michael. Heidi, did you hear about this? They want to call this museum they're putting on top of this ancient cemetery the Museum of Tolerance.
It's such an irony.
Yes, we have covered it, but, you know, not news is changing, and we're not going to spend a long time on it because we'll do some other programs on it. But we're becoming a critical moment, or a critical mass is arising, really, in some protest against Israel's practices and policies of both, you'd have to call the erasing of the Arab and Palestinian presence from East Jerusalem, taking over the West Bank, the Gaza Report, and even the United States, finally, for a variety of reasons, is finally beginning to talk somewhat more severely to Israel.
The shame of desecrating another people's cemetery, and really the heritage of the whole world, is one thing. But the Israelis have finally managed to get the American army aggravated. And General Petraeus, who's in charge of that whole area, had a report commissioned, and that report was taken to the Congress. And the report said that the actions of the Israelis are hurting the United States' efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places, that the Arabs continue to hate the United States because of its favoritism towards Israel, and that, in fact, it's costing American lives.
And I didn't listen to the whole speech, but Hillary's speech to the APEC, the American Israeli lobbying group, pro-Israel lobbying group in Washington, was actually quite strong for a Hillary speech, quite critical of what Israel has been doing.
Mark Thiessen, former speechwriter in the Bush administration, has a new book out titled Courting Disaster. And he has something to say about our own Michael Ratner.
But before we go there, Courting Disaster is a book that tries to justify the Bush torture program. This guy, Mark Thiessen, worked for Jesse Helms for a while. Then he got elevated, if you want to call it that, to torturer-in-chief Donald Rumsfeld. And then he got pushed up a little more into Bush. and wrote some of Bush's speeches around torture and justifying torture and all of this kind of stuff. I was reading this on the torture listserv that I'm on a few months ago, and the outrage of the torture listserv, because he then got hired by the Washington Post to be a columnist.
He's an online columnist.
Is that right? Is that right? He's an online columnist. Now, Jane Mayer, in a New Yorker article that Heidi's going to describe, really takes on Thiessen about this book. And what does she call him in the book?
Well, before that, let me just say, Michael's going to quote from that part. But she says that the book has a scholarly feel with hundreds of footnotes, but is based on a series of slipshod premises. Then she goes on to say, Michael...
She says it's full of outlandish falsehoods. This is in her article in The New Yorker of March 29th, 2010, Counterfactual, A Curious History of the CIA's Secret Interrogation Program. And you know, Heidi and Michael, this is on the Times bestseller list, this book.
It's amazing. And it's just, you know, I was thinking the other day, if I sat down and wrote a book that was filled with falsehoods, you know, counterfactual arguments, you know, I actually wouldn't be capable of doing it. I don't understand how someone can do it. This guy is now a Washington Post columnist, a New York Times bestseller, and Jane goes through in three pages of this article and really demolishes the premises that he has. Let's just give you one example. He claims that the waterboarding, I think it's what it is, of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or the torture, eventually leads to the plot that was planned in England to bomb 7 airplanes coming out of Heathrow. And Jane is able to talk to people who knew about that plot in Scotland Yard and said that had nothing to do with it. They discovered the plot entirely on their own, had nothing to do with waterboarding or torturing anyone.
Yeah, and he talks about how counterproductive it was. In fact, one of the people that the United States sent to Egypt to be tortured then came out with false information saying there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Colin Powell then gave that famous speech at the UN saying there was weapons of mass destruction, and that was used to justify the illegal and genocidal war against the Iraqi people.
That's al-Libi, and al-Libi was tortured by the Egyptians. He was turned over to the Egyptians by the CIA. He basically, quote, confessed to saying that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, as you said, Colin Powell then uses that information to convince the UN, never convinced the UN, but at least the American people, some of them Congress people, to back the war.
What's distressing is that this book is not only a bestseller, but it's really getting traction. Jane Mayer, whose book, The Dark Side, really deserved to be a bestseller, concludes her New Yorker article with this observation. The publication of Courting Disaster suggests that Obama's avowed determination to, quote, look forward, not back, end quote, has laid the recent past open to partisan interpretation and reinterpretation. By holding no one accountable for past abuse and by convening no commission on what did and didn't protect our country, President Obama has left the telling of this dark chapter in American history to those who most want to whitewash it.
Which brings us, though, to one of the reasons we're discussing Mark Thiessen and his book is that he's just come out on weeklystandard.com with an entire article on Michael Ratner, lead terrorist defender.
The dean of the Gitmo Bar. Meet Michael Ratner, lead terrorist defender. Michael.
And the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And
the
center. Here's where I always think of our hero, Bill Kunstler, right? Any publicity is better than no publicity.
When I read this red-baiting, violence-baiting piece of trash that really goes after the rule of law, when I read it, I thought, you know, Michael Ratner's my dear friend. You can tell something about a person not just by his friends but by his enemies. When I read this, you were elevated even higher in my esteem.
It is a red-baiting piece of trash, his article. There's no doubt about it. You know, the fact that they feel they feel it necessary. First, they went after the Guantanamo lawyers, former Guantanamo lawyers who worked for the administration. And that they got a little bit of traction, but it didn't seem to get enough. And so now they're trying to undermine the Guantanamo representation by attacking the Center for Constitutional Rights, by attacking the center through me, really, saying, here's the president of the center, and this is what he believes about Cuba, this is what he believes about Guantanamo, this is what Bill Kunstler said, this is XYZ, and trying to really put some light between the center, which coordinates all the Guantanamo litigation, and the lawyers who are doing it all over the world.
I think that he went out to assassinate your character, although the strongest thing he says about you is that you're actually trying to uphold the rule of law. But I think also he's trying to undermine the financial support that the center gets. He's trying to undermine the many major white shoe law firms to to their credit, you know, came forward to support the Constitution. He names them by name.
You know, let's just hope we're not in a period like we were in the 50s where, you know, labeling people, essentially hanging signs like the letter A in Scarlet Letter around their necks, separates them from others who care about human rights and civil liberties in the United States. And it's crucial. And that's why I don't think it will, because when there was the attack on the lawyers before in the center by Cully Stimson, who was the Pentagon detainee affairs guy, they fought back the lawyers. And they said, this is outrageous. We're representing these people. And I'm hopeful that they will continue their vigorous representation of Guantanamo detainees and others in the so-called war on terror. Many listeners may not have heard of hydrofracturing, but it's a way of drilling for natural gas that takes thousands and millions of gallons of water. And the end result may be natural gas, but it's also an incredible amount of pollution. Pollution in the water system, pollution on the land it's drilling from, and pollution ultimately of the aquifers of possibly this entire country. There is an aggressive effort now to drill in what is called the Marcellus Shale, which is approximately a mile to a mile and a half underground. There's also similar shale groupings throughout the United States, so this is not just a northeastern problem. The shale is believed to hold some of the world's largest deposits of natural gas. The environmental and public costs, however, opponents say is too high. They point out that gas drilling causes increased runoff because the water used in drilling won't be returned to the stream. There will be more erosion, water quality will worsen. The lesson is clear from other locations that have done some of the same drilling. Near the Jonah gas field in Wyoming, there was a drop in wildlife of 50%, loss of businesses, a drop in property values, accidents like wildfires, more traffic, and a greater need for emergency services. These are just some of the impacts of gas drilling. Last week, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, said it will investigate how hydraulic fracturing will impact water supplies and water quality in New York State. The Upper Delaware River watershed basin is the source of pure water for 20 million people in Philadelphia, New York City, and half of New Jersey. 171 products and 245 chemicals are used among millions of gallons of water and sand. Halliburton's gas well drilling process is now exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Right to Know Act. Today we are joined by Susan Blankensop to talk more about this issue and the Damascus Citizens Group in Pennsylvania and the ongoing battle to stop this kind of hydraulic fracturing and drilling for natural gas. Susan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Susan, how did you get involved in fighting against the gas drilling?
Well, I live in New York City, and I have a part-time residence in Pennsylvania, in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. In January of 2008, some neighbors of mine, we started hearing about these landsmen coming around the neighborhood and speaking to private landowners and coming up to the doors and offering them money for their mineral rights under the land. And it was all very hush-hush and very secretive, and they would say, well, don't tell your neighbor that I'm here because I'm offering you a better deal. And it's only good for 2 days, take it or leave it, that kind of thing. So then we started hearing about this Marcellus Shale, this deep shale layer where they felt that there were very, you know, like huge pockets of natural gas. So then we started hearing about the Marcellus Shale and then this process called hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling. And we just started doing research to find out what exactly was going on, where this shale level was, what was so important, you know, what was so secretive and what was so important about it. So we really started from zero, knowing nothing, back in January of 2008. And then in the past 2 years, we've learned quite a bit.
Now, were you specifically approached by the gas company?
No, I have a pretty small parcel of land, and I was not specifically approached, but my neighbors on all sides of me were approached.
And what kind of money were they offering?
Well, back then, and I'm not, you know, this has been going on. They've known about this shale level for a long time, so I'm sure they were there long before we started knowing about it. But back in early 08, I'd say they were offering $25 an acre up front, $50 an acre up front, no royalties if the well produced. Now the ranges, a large landowners alliance in Wayne County signed a lease for $3,500 per acre with, I believe it was 15 or 18% royalties. So there's a lot of money to be made by some large landowners.
Because there's farmers up there who have 50, 100, 200 acres,
exactly.
And they can't afford to keep their farms, or they're not growing
exactly.
crops.
It's a valid issue.
Some guy
issue.
Comes along, $2,000 or $3,000 an acre. I mean, that's a huge amount, plus royalties. It's a huge amount
it's
of
a
money.
Huge amount. That's if the wells produce, and it stands to be seen what wells will produce, how much they will produce. There's a lot of speculation.
And what does Halliburton have to do with all of this?
Well, Halliburton was the company that really developed this process of hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling.
Tell us what exactly we're talking about with hydrofracturing. What do they do and what's the danger of it?
Well, hydrofracturing is the process where they drill down into these deep shale levels. They go vertically down about a mile to a mile and a half
wow.
down into the earth. They're
Whoa.
Very deep levels.
5,000 to 7,000 feet.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So they go down till they reach the shale level, and then they develop this horizontal drilling where they turn the bore head horizontally, and they drill horizontally into the shale levels, and then they start setting off these mini explosions under very high pressure and velocity of water, chemicals, and sand that create these fissures in the rock formations, and then the fissures are propped open with the sand, allowing the gas to escape back up the well.
What's the risk of doing that to the people that live on top of it?
Well, one is the huge amounts of water, clean water, that they use. And this, each time they drill a well, the estimates are anywhere from 5 to 9 million gallons of water just to drill one well. And then each time they fracture a well, it's another 5 to 9 million gallons estimates. And they can fracture a well multiple times. So it's the huge amounts of water they're using. Where are they getting that water from? The huge amounts of chemicals, over 275 different toxic chemicals that they use, mixing into the fluid to help their surfactants, their acids, their friction reducers, all kinds of things. And then once they've drilled the well, they end up with all these millions of gallons of industrial waste product, this chemical, radioactive-laced water.
Is it left in the ground? Or
some
it
of
come
it is
up?
Left in the ground. Again, these are estimates, but right. depending on the formation, 40 to 70% of it stays underground, where it risks migrating through those new fissures they've just exploded into, back up into the water aquifers and back into the water system. And then the part 40 to 70% of it that comes back up through the well, they have to dispose of it. So that's a whole disposal issue. They've got a number of ways that they can go about doing that. One is that they build these evaporation pits on site at the well. There's these big holes in the ground. They line them with plastic. The water sits there and evaporates, and they have various techniques with sprayers, et cetera, that help speed up that evaporation. But basically, they end up with this sludge that they then have to dispose of. I'm not even sure how they dispose of that.
Now, what does the Environmental Protection Agency have to say about this?
Well, it's not totally clear. Right now, for instance, this past summer, the New York State DEC put forward their guidelines that they thought were these finished guidelines that were going to be regulating this process in New York State. There was a public comment period for those guidelines. There were various places where people were allowed to come and give their comments and have their questions answered. None of those were held in New York City. Until last fall, when they finally held one, where was it? Battery Park City, Stuyvesant High School, attended by hundreds and hundreds of people, very, very upset about this process. So they only had one public forum, you know, for New York City. 90% of New York City's water comes from the Catskill-Delaware watershed, which is ground zero of this Marcellus shale play.
Yeah, let me ask you about the scope of it, because we're talking about the Marcellus shale, which covers what part of at least the east?
As I know it, the Marcellus Shale runs all the way up through West Virginia, parts of Ohio, most of Pennsylvania, sort of runs up north and east up through Pennsylvania and into the southern tier of New York State.
And this is the area that is potentially subject to this kind of what you call vertical and then horizontal drilling.
Well, all of these deep shale levels are going to use the same process of deep drilling, hydrofracturing, and horizontal drilling. That's the only way they can financially accessed.
And do you have any sense of of how much land they've already leased up for this?
You know, I can't give you a good number on that, but I know
millions of acres already. So this is a huge thing, not just for the landowner, but obviously for all of us who want our water from these areas.
Yes. The landowners stand to gain from this, but everybody's going to be affected by the contamination of the water, the air quality issues. There are compressor stations, there are noise issues, the damage to the roads, the hundreds and hundreds of water trucks and chemical trucks that are going to be on these little country roads. It's going to turn the countryside into an industrial zone. All of the other industries that areas upstate, particularly my area, tourism, fishing, camping, kayaking, nobody's going to want to come to an area like that for those activities.
You know, strikes me as it's like the other side of the coin to mountaintop removal.
Exactly.
They haven't started doing it yet, though. What's the timetable here?
Well, in New York State, they're waiting for the final review of this New York State DEC guidelines. But the federal EPA came out with a statement warning that those guidelines were totally inadequate and warned them that they had not looked at the very real risks, important issues like what the long-term and cumulative effects of this kind of contamination will be on the water systems.
You know what's amazing about that? You know, Michael and I both have places upstate in the Catskills. Uh-huh. And, you know, if I put my toe in the reservoir, I get like a $200 ticket or something, and I can be banned from fishing there.
Exactly.
And yet this is a state that then essentially in its regulations said, guys, go for it.
Yeah.
Do as much drilling as you want. And then it takes the federal EPA to come along and say, New York State, this is bad. And yet they have thousands of police cars running around up in the Catskills, not allowing me to fish essentially
right.
or anything.
A person can't even put an above ground swimming pool in their backyard without major
right.
permitting. Yet the oil and gas industry is exempted. And they received those exemptions in the 2005 Energy Act, which was supposedly, I think, basically getting U.S. off of dependence on foreign oil and gas. But basically, they received oil and gas industry received exemptions from all of the major environmental laws, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Streams Law,
amazing.
The Clean Air Act.
So
basically, the hydrofracturing has no federal regulating body.
And who was the vice president at that time? Or some people
Dick
argue
Cheney.
The real president.
Who was also
Dick
head
Cheney?
Of Halliburton.
Who was the head of Halliburton?
Now, let me ask a question about geographical scope. We know about the Northeast. Now, there has been some of this has gone on, at least I think in Wyoming and maybe other places. So there's other places in the United States where this may happen?
It's already happening in a lot of other parts of the United States. There are various shale formations. Not all of it is Marcellus shale, but there are deep shale formations. Texas, Colorado, Wyoming, Alabama, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, both eastern and western Pennsylvania, Utah, West Virginia. I mean, it's happening all over the country.
Susan, I'm curious, do you know of any landowners who have sold the rights and are now regretting it?
I do know a couple of people that, you know, initially, as I say, this was very secretive. People were coming in saying, look, we just want your mineral rights, and this is a basic lease. All the leases are the same, and there's not going to be any contamination. Don't worry. We'll put the well way over here. You won't see it. You won't hear it. We're not going to disrupt your – we're not going to cut down trees. No problem. And people said, oh, well, okay, this can help me pay my mortgage. This can help me buy some new livestock. This can send my kids to college or whatever. But – they didn't realize they really were being lied to by omission because they weren't telling them what the process was really about.
And are any of these individuals bringing legal challenges based on fraud, misrepresentation?
In Dimmock, Pennsylvania, Cabot Oil, there were numerous instances of contamination. One woman's water well literally exploded. It had a huge cement slab on top of it and so much methane built up in the well that her water well exploded, fractured into many parts. Other people in Dimmock, Pennsylvania were actually lighting the water coming out of their faucets, their kitchen faucets. There was a group lawsuit that they started against Cabot to try and, you know, I mean, these people are getting their water trucked in.
The lighting of the faucet reminds me of the opening of the film.
Yes.
I don't remember the name of the film, but
Gasland.
It opens. Gasland is
yes.
the name, and
uh-huh.
I guess people will be able to see that in the next
yes.
few months.
Josh Fox is the director. It's called Gasland. He spent the last 2 years traveling around the country documenting this.
It opens with someone turning their faucet,
yes.
and gas comes out, and they have a match, and they light it, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And
It's a good party trick, but you can also imagine the deadly chemicals that are in that water also.
Let's talk about resistance a little bit in organizing. Mm-hmm. First, talk about what your own local organizing and then where it's happening more nationally or around the country and what people can think about.
Well, I think it's important for people to stay as local as they can with the organizations because each area is a little bit different and what people's needs are going to be a little bit different. For instance, Damascus Citizens is the group in Pennsylvania that I am a member of. It's a nonprofit advocacy group, and it's really trying to get the information out to the public, and it's trying to protect the waters of the Delaware River, which is the watersheds for parts of New Jersey and Philadelphia.
Apart from being a great trout stream, which I know.
And shad fishing also,
right.
Game fishing.
Right.
Yeah, really world-renowned trout fishing.
Right.
I've never gotten a trout in that river, but...
You gotten shad?
I never have, no.
We use cherry bombs.
Oh, do you?
No. So, okay, so there's the Damascus group. And what kind of... Give us a sense of the activities.
Well, we do a lot of fundraising, of course, because, we're a grassroots organization. We do a lot of forums of... where people can come. We'll have speakers talking about the risks to the water, risks to the environment, water experts. There's a woman named Dr. Theo Colburn who's been studying this process for years. She's an endocrinologist, and she studied the toxic effects of these chemicals that they use in the gas drilling. So she's come back and forth and spoken at some of these forums. People can ask questions. So we just feel that the more people really understand about the issue, the more alarmed they'll be and the more clout they'll have in terms of going to their representatives and their assemblymen and trying to get laws in place to either ban it in areas where it's inappropriate, such as watersheds, or regulate it heavily and make sure that the public health and the public drinking water is safe.
I mean, apart from the money that can be made on it, I guess one of the pushes is that to make us essentially oil-free in some way, right? I mean, it's something like that.
Yeah, but soaking the sun and the wind.
No, I understand. I'm just saying.
That's a valid argument. I mean, and natural gas, as I understand it, burns relatively cleaner than oil and coal. It's still a hydrocarbon. It's still polluting. And the extraction process is what nobody ever talks about. And that process, the hydrofracturing and the horizontal drilling, are highly contaminating processes. You have to balance out the cleanness on one end and the toxic, waste on the other.
It's amazing it's gotten this far to me. I mean, when I read about it, it's just shocking that it got so far
clean
already.
Clean natural gas.
And given the forces backing this, I think it's going to get a lot farther. I mean, I think this is the beginning.
Now that the environmental EPA went after New York State, at least it's something, right?
I think we need help on the federal level, and there is a bill that's been introduced called the FRAC Act on the federal level that wants to rescind those exemptions that they receive from the major environmental laws.
Michael's point is, with a president that believes in clean coal.
Let's talk about Damascus Citizens Group. How have you grown over the last year or so? It seems that I've been reading more about this or running into more individuals who know about it and are trying to, propel the movement.
It's definitely grown. Our membership, I can't give you the numbers on that, but, we started out with a group of 25, 30 people in somebody's barn, looking at a video projection of slides of, the contamination. And now there are, I don't know, but a lot of people are on board. And there are a lot of environmental groups that are, working on this issue, not just Damascus Citizens. And here in New York City, the NYH2O group is another nonprofit advocacy group that's really focusing more on New York City's watersheds and New York State's drinking water.
It's called NYH2O.
NYH2O. And they have a website.
What is it?
NYH2O.org.
So there's a bill pending, lots of grassroots activity. Are there other local organizations in addition to Damascus Citizens Group?
Damascus Citizens Group is really a Pennsylvania-based group. I should have a list of those.
You can just look it up under, what's the keyword you would put in?
I would put...
Fracturing?
Yeah, hydrofracturing. Look that up. And banning gas drilling. There's something like 63 environmental groups, Earth Justice, NRDC, that have come on board with this and are trying to get bans in areas and regulation.
And has Mayor Bloomberg come out with a position on this?
He did. Last year, the mayor's office did a study for about 9 months, pretty in-depth, peer-reviewed study, And they determined last fall that the risks were too great to allow this drilling to happen in New York City's watersheds or anywhere near the watersheds, like the drainage areas for the watersheds.
Big area.
And then just recently, again, he came out with another statement in support of the federal EPA's study that they're starting that's going to look into the issues of water contamination and public health that will be affected by this drilling.
Well, you know, New York City used to be famous for having the most pure water in the country.
Yeah.
And that's no longer the case. Real estate development, runoff pollution has made it not so pure anymore.
Uh-huh.
And this is a threat to make it even worse.
So you're saying that right at this point, even there's a threat to losing that non-filtered drinking water status the development?
We're actually under a federal rule right now because we don't meet the drinking standards of the Clean Water Act.
Okay. Well, just wait and put a few wells in that watershed and we will definitely use it. And the estimates on the cost of that filtration plant are $10, $20 billion just to build it.
That's correct.
Operating costs, there go our water rates.
The city has been buying all the land in the Catskills that surround the reservoirs, all of it. Everything that comes up, they buy it at a lot of money, billions of dollars, because they want to avoid having to do filtration. And their hope is that they'll keep construction down. But this will finish it sounds like.
I mean, it is an amazing system that was put into place, that whole reservoir and natural filtration. It's amazing that New York City, the size of it, has.
It is.
It was one of the great engineering feats in the world
when
it happened in the 19-teens. A number of towns, Michael knows quite a lot about this, a number of towns were knocked down and removed. A dam was constructed by hand.
Uh-huh.
You have these huge lakes really up there, which are our water supply.
Yeah.
You can't swim in them.
It's
this
beautiful.
Is why I thank God for gravity, right? Comes actually all down by gravity. It's amazing.
Naturally filtered. It's amazing. Right. It is amazing.
Susan, I understand we have a couple of events coming up in New York City.
Yes, on April 1st, John Jay College, there will be a forum on the effects of natural gas drilling. And there will be some amazing speakers there. Albert Appleton, who's an expert on the New York City watersheds. Deborah Goldberg from Earth Justice and about three other speakers. There will be speakers. There will be question and answer period. So it will really be to inform people about what the risks of this process are. And also on April 15th at Cooper Union in the evening, NYH2O, I believe Earth Justice, are co-sponsoring another forum. Again, with speakers, and Dr. Theo Colburn from Colorado, the endocrinologist, will be there speaking. So those are two great events for people to go to. I think the things that people can do are to go to these various, like NYH2O has a monthly newsletter out on their website now, and it updates information and petitions and things that people can be doing to get involved. Damascus Citizens website also, they have lots of information. People should go out and see that film, Gasland. It's amazing, and it really gives a very clear picture of what's happening around the country.
And that film won an award at Sundance, didn't it?
Yeah, it won the Special Jury Award Prize at Sundance this fall. And also, there's an online petition to Governor Patterson. I mean, if he would just say, rescind that New York State, the DEC's ESGEIS as inadequate and start over, then that would work. So a petition to sign the online petition to Governor Patterson. Natural gas is a little confusing. It sounds natural, but it's not. The extraction process just isn't.
Good point. Susan Blankensop, it's been such an honor to have you on here, and we look forward to hearing some positive developments over the next few months.
I'd be happy to come back and tell you all of those positive developments.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
is Eli Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a panel at the recent Left Forum in New York City. The panel was called How to Make a Revolution in the U.S., and our own Michael Smith was chair. We hear now from historian Paul LeBlanc.
Paul LeBlanc is a professor of history at La Roche College in Pittsburgh. He's written a number of books on American radical and labor history. He's been involved in the movement since 1965. I remember when he was in SDS back in the 60s. And he's been in a number of different organizations. Title of this year's Left Forum is called The Center Cannot Hold. Does anybody know where that comes from? W.H. Auden wrote a poem, and it starts off, I was sitting in a bar on 52nd Street. He was a jazz fan. And he wrote it on September 1st, 1939, the day the Second World War started. And one of the lines in the poem is, the center cannot hold. And it didn't. And that was chosen as the theme of the Left Forum for similar reasons. If we don't build a left and we don't have people on the left, the center can't hold either, and things are going to go over to the right. You can see that happening already. The idea behind this panel was to talk about how you can build that kind of movement on the left. We used a provocative title, How to Make a Revolution in the United States, not because any of us think that that's an imminent possibility. Although, given the crises of this society, there could be something disastrous around the corner. We all know that. And if that happened, we're not in any shape to take advantage of it. We cannot provide any kind of alternative leadership to this country at this stage. But we chose that title to talk about not just how one organizes for a revolution, but how one struggles for reforms in a revolutionary way. The key to winning reforms has always been through American history. Well, this wasn't a reform, but struggle against slavery, which had a revolutionary outcome, was initiated independent. The struggle for women's rights, the struggle against Jim Crow, American apartheid, the struggle for the labor movement, the struggle for gay and lesbian rights, the struggle for an end to the war in Vietnam. All of those originated outside of the two-party structure and were effective because they originated there and were effective to the extent that they stayed there. With that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Paul. Paul's going to make a presentation. So with that, let me turn the mic over to Paul LeBlanc.
Thanks. One of the things that I do often is I share this information. This is from the mid-1960s. This was on the front cover of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It's worse now than it was then. But 1% of the families owned 40% of the wealth. And then the next 19% of the families owned 40% of the wealth. And I'm a terrible mathematician, but I know that means that the top 20% of the families own 80% of the wealth. And then there's the rest of us, 80% of the people owning 20% of the wealth. And when we're talking about wealth, we're not just talking about money, we're talking about power. We're talking about economic power that translates into political power. And that's these figures for the United States, roughly the same kind of figures could be drawn for the whole world. This is an international reality, this inequality of wealth and power. And a revolution involves flipping this. And ultimately, so there's not a 20% and an 80%, but there is an equal share of wealth and power, an economic democracy that is ruled by the people throughout the world, with the working class majorities, the oppressed, no longer accepting the rulership of the high and mighty over them. That's a revolution, and that's what we need. But how do we get that, given that they have so much power? They have so much power. And we have numbers, but they have power. And one thing is that there are crises. We're hitting crises, and capitalism generates crises. It's an economic crisis, ecological crisis, so forth and so on, which means that it will be impossible for them to govern in the way that they have governed given the crises that are erupting and hurting more and more of the 80% and even nibbling away at the 20%. But the problem with that is that the crises themselves do not generate the solutions. Have any of you seen the movie Children of Men? I recommend Children of Men because it shows and it makes allusions to big global justice demonstrations once upon a time, but that didn't change the balance of power in society. And if we do not change the balance of power in society, we will be facing the reality that Rosa Luxemburg told us about shortly before she was killed, that humanity faces, it's at a crossroads. Either it moves forward to socialism, ruled by the people over the economic resources of our planet, of our society. If we do not have that, the rational use of our resources to meet the needs of all people, democratic control over that, if we do not have that, then there will be a downward slide into barbarism. Things will get worse and worse and worse. Simply because there are crises doesn't mean that things will get better somehow. People who are struggling for social change can be co-opted and absorbed by those who have power. Those who have power can make adjustments. They can repress those who are struggling for social justice and human rights for all. That will happen. That is what happens. That is what they do. And the problems will get worse in multiple ways and can destroy everything that is valuable to us unless we stop them from what they are doing. So the question is, how can we stop them? One of the other things that we have to look at besides the recurring crises that capitalism generates, which stirs things up and shakes things up, is the fact, and it didn't come through last night, it did not come through in the discussion that Jesse Jackson was having with folks, with the one folk, and it didn't come through in his statements, that we are in a global context. This is international reality. We are facing international crises. There are international struggles throughout Latin America, in the Middle East, you know, throughout Africa and Asia and so forth and so on, and in Europe. So it's not simply what's going to happen in the United States. We have to think globally, not simply in terms of the crises, but in terms of the struggles that are going on. One of the things I believe that means for us, and again, it did not come up in any clear way last night, a responsibility for those of us who are revolutionary socialists, who believe in human rights for all, liberty and justice for all on this planet, is that we have to oppose imperialism, and especially the imperialism of our own country. Imperialism, that is, economic expansion beyond the borders of our own country, to secure markets, raw materials, and investment opportunities for that 1%, for those who own and control the multinational corporations, which exist not to meet the needs of the people of the earth, the peoples of the earth, but to maximize profits for those who have economic power. That's imperialism, and they will do whatever is necessary to maintain and establish their power and profits and accumulate greater power and profits. And they are doing that in Iraq and Afghanistan especially, and it threatens to spread to other parts of that region, and it exists in many parts of the world, and we have a responsibility to oppose that. And that is central to what we must do if we are serious about making a revolution in the United States or even standing up for what is right in the United States. For me, that means that I must be involved in helping to build the anti-war movement in this country. And I believe we have, that is a central responsibility. That is not the only thing that we need to be doing, but that is one thing that we must be doing. And we are not going to make a revolution tomorrow, but I think we have to make a revolution soon. I'm old. I think I'm going to die before we make that revolution. But not too long after I die, we must make that revolution or we will have the Children of Men scenario, a downward slide into barbarism. So we must see what we do now. We must take it seriously. And we must see how it connects with this responsibility not only to stand up for what's right, but to bring about a revolution where these figures don't apply anymore, where the majority of the people of this country and of this planet have control of the economy. Okay, and that's what I mean by socialism, and that's what we need. We need to replace capitalism, which is going to kill us, with socialism, in my opinion. Most people don't agree with that. Most people in this country don't even know what the word socialism means. That's a problem, and that's one of the things we must do if we're going to be responsible is to change that situation. I think that a majority of the people in this country are kind of against the wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's one of the reasons they voted for Obama in large numbers, because they were opposed to that. And they thought Obama was going to end that. But Obama, and that's interesting to discuss what Obama said and what he did and what he represents, but he wanted to be president of these United States. He wanted to be president of the American Empire, and that has meant that he has committed us to stay in Iraq as long as is necessary and to fight and win in Afghanistan. This is Obama's war, and there are a number of people who weren't prepared for that, who are uncertain what does that mean and confused, but they do not support the war. A majority of the people are not behind the war, but the anti-war movement is incredibly weak. If we compare this situation, and it's different in many ways, but there are similarities too, with the situation with the war in Vietnam, where we built a massive anti-war movement, even when a majority of the people were confused and suckered into supporting the war. And we helped to turn that into an anti-war majority that was being mobilized, putting pressure on Democrats as well as Republicans. And we mobilized some Republicans, and we mobilized a lot of Democrats, and we mobilized people who weren't sure about either of those parties, but people who were in agreement that the war had to end, that the U.S. troops had to be withdrawn from Vietnam, that this was a no-good war. And we connected that war with the struggle for economic and social justice in this country. We cannot have social justice in this country with that war raging. Martin Luther King Jr. was one of the people who saw that and said it and broke with the Democrats in order to push that understanding. And we must do the same kind of thing now. One of the things that I've thought about, and I'm interested in Leslie's thoughts too, and in some of us who are old, who lived during that period of time, and who are living in this period of time, and there are many wonderful things happening. There are a number of young activists here who weren't born then, or you were toddlers then, or something. But one of the things that I notice in the movement is that there's a certain lack of what I would call cadre, and that is people who have a certain a knack of analyzing things, the big picture, developing strategy, developing tactics, who know how to make a leaflet, who know how to organize a meeting, who know how to use a series of meetings that will result in a demonstration, and that demonstration will be part of an overarching strategy that will build an increasingly militant and radical majority. And I learned that from old-timers. I learned that from people who were in the Communist Party. I learned it from people who were in the Socialist Party, people who were in the Socialist Workers' Party, radical pacifists like A.J. Mustey and those who were clustered around. They taught us how to do that kind of thinking, that kind of organizing, that kind of practical stuff. And it seems to me that many younger activists are learning it on their own. There aren't the organizations, the left-wing organizations that were an essential part of building a real civil rights movement, a real anti-war movement, et cetera, the various social movements that made such a change in the 60s and in the early 70s. And it seems to me one of the things we must do if we're serious about revolution is developing cadre, developing organizations that will develop cadre, and there's more than one that's going to do it. You know, I decided at a certain point to join one of them. There are various other ones. We must help to develop activists who are going to be in it for the long haul, who have an analysis and the tools to develop analysis in a changing situation and the organizational skills. That's one of the things that we need. And then a strategic perspective that links struggles in the here and now. I think it is possible to do what we did with the Vietnam War. We didn't end the Vietnam War, but we were a key factor in ending the Vietnam War. We mobilized a majority of people, you know, in terms of their thinking and in terms of increasing numbers, against the war in Vietnam. And the politicians and the policymakers were under pressure, because if they continued with that vicious and imperialist war against the desires and the hopes and the beliefs and the thinking of the majority of people, they would be discredited. And so there were limitations put on what they could do. And that, combined with the struggle of the Vietnamese people themselves, combined with increasing rebellion in the ranks of the U.S. armed forces, combined with an alignment of international relationships, these things together brought an end to the war. It limited what the war makers could do, and at a certain point, they had to pull out. And we were a key factor in that, and we can be a key factor in doing the same thing with Iraq and Afghanistan. And we can do it before there is a socialist revolution. But we need a socialist revolution. And the way that we do this anti-war thing needs to be a model for the way that we do the economic justice struggles, worker struggles, and so forth. Fighting for victories in the here and now, reaching the consciousness of more and more people, the majority of whom are not going to be ready for socialism now, but they'll be ready to stand up for their rights, they'll be ready to stand up for what is right, they'll be ready to struggle, and that will bring them into collision with the power structure as it did back then, and that will generate a greater radicalization with more people considering revolutionary and socialist and Marxist ideas. That will create more and more a radical consciousness, a socialist consciousness, with more and more people getting experience in the struggles and becoming part of revolutionary organizations that are ready to take the next step and the next step and prevent a Children of Men scenario from happening, moving forward to socialism instead of allowing for a downward slide into barbarism. That's my thinking. It's kind of abstract in a way, and yet it is related to experiences some of us lived through and experiences that we're facing now. So that's my little contribution to this part of the discussion. I'm looking forward to hearing what others have to say, and we'll share ideas together.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul LeBlanc.
That was an excerpt from a panel at the Left Forum titled How to Make a Revolution in the U.S.
We have a special treat. We're going to hear from Wallace Shawn, or as we call him, Wally Shawn, who's an Obie Award-winning playwright and actor. He's written plays Aunt Dan and Lemon, The Fever, The Designated Mourner, and Grasses of a Thousand Colors. He's co-written two films, My Dinner with Andre and Marie and Bruce. He also wrote an opera with Alan Shawn entitled The Music Teacher. The reason we're going to play these is that the other day I was reading a new book by Wally Shawn, Essays by Wallace Shawn, and they were so amazing and so political and so strong that I asked him if he had recorded them so that we could play them on the air or if he'd come and read one. Well, the other day I got in the mail a 4-CD set called Essays by Wallace Shawn. So today we're going to play you one that I think is particularly strong and striking. It's short, and it's what Wallace, or Wally Shawn, has to say about patriotism. So here it is, Wallace Shawn on patriotism.
Patriotism, 1991. In July 1991, The Nation magazine asked various people to submit brief reflections on patriotism. Patriotism can seem to be as harmless as the love of certain musical instruments, food, a landscape. Certain personalities from one's own country can seem so charming, so delightful. But patriotism always seems to mean, if you feel a fondness for your country, that it ought to be worth it to you to do X. Patriotism is considered to be an emotion a person ought to feel. But why? Why is it nobler to love your own country than to love someone else's? Why is it particularly wonderful to think that the place you're from is the greatest in the world? Why should individuals speak in the first person plural about our ideals and the things we believe? If certain great figures from our country's past have had valuable insights, by all means, let's be inspired by them. But let's not make a fetish out of it. The United States is a monster that must be stopped, controlled. It's too elaborate to say, again and again, we must change our current behavior because it violates our noble traditions. The historical point is probably untrue, and anyway, it doesn't matter. What's necessary is to change the behavior. We don't need to be flattered while we're doing it. And in any case, even if we have some noble ancestors, that wouldn't mean that we have any particular merit. For citizens of small, weak countries, patriotism might be connected to a yearning for justice. For people who are despised, who despise themselves, more self-esteem might be a good thing. But for people who already are in love with themselves, who worship themselves, who consider themselves more important than others, more self-esteem is not needed. Self-knowledge would be considerably more helpful.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.